This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today, we are once again interviewing Ranger Ryan Trimbath of Cuyahoga Valley National Park, just a few miles south of Cleveland, Ohio, and Lake Erie. Ryan Trimbath is the ranger biologist at Cuyahoga Valley National Park, where he has worked for the last 7 years. Ryan holds a degree in wildlife conservation biology from Ohio University and is working on a PhD in integrated biosciences. He has the honor of being the only ornithologist to ever hold a living northern Perula and cerulean warbler hybrid that he discovered in the park 10 years ago. His most recent project is focused on freshwater mussel restoration in the Cuyahoga River. So, Ryan, welcome. It's great to be talking to you again. We have a lot more to cover, so let's get to it.
So, now we can talk about mammals. What kind of mammals do you have in the park?
So pretty much all the, not all the mammals that are common to, you know, the eastern U.S., but the ones that can tolerate a developed urban, suburban, rural habitat. So deer are here and very abundant. It's one of our management challenges.
What kind of deer? Whitetail?
Yeah, white-tailed, sorry. So large mammals like that, white-tailed deer are a large mammal. We don't have bear. We do get a periodic bear show up either in the neighboring community or within the park from year to year. We have started to see potentially more records of bobcats, so potentially bobcats, I think, in the future. They've been expanding in Ohio, southern Ohio mainly. I think it's a matter of decades before they're, of a decade or so before they're, you know, regularly inhabiting here. Coyotes are abundant. Red fox are abundant. Just thinking of some of the larger charismatic ones. Gray fox are rare around here, but we did recently have a record of a gray fox, which is really exciting. Small mammals, there's a long list of shrews and voles, jumping mice and things that are here.
Are there any martins or fishers?
What's that?
Martins or fishers?
Martins or fishers, no. Okay. Just mink. Mink's the closest thing, yeah. There's a question of whether or not the martins or fisher were here in the past. We are kind of, so if you go east to Pennsylvania, you get more into like the world of porcupines and things like that. We do have some of the, you know, some hemlock ravines and historically had white pine was more common, but the communities are fishers and martin seem to be outside of, historically, possibly outside of our area. Still figuring it out.
Any raccoons come into the park?
Well, we got all the raccoons you could ask for. Yeah, raccoons are here. We have put out bear-safe garbage cans all over the park, but that's because we have so many raccoons. This is helping us keep the raccoons out of our garbage cans.
Yeah. How about bats?
Yes, bats. I figured you'd get to bats. We're really excited about bats right now around here, Ohio has historically about 11 species of bats. We recently did a study, an acoustic study, monitoring bats, and confirmed we had about 9 of those 11 species in the park. That's what's declining. Those are the species of conservation concern, of greatest conservation concern here at Cuyahoga Valley National Park. We, like many other places, have experienced the impacts of white nose syndrome. White nose syndrome showed up around 2012. We do have a hibernacula at the Virginia Kendall ledges. And ever since 2012, we just have seen regionally a steady decline in the bat abundance and diversity throughout the park. We have the, we do have a record of the Indiana bat. So back in early 2000, we did a what is called the park-wide inventory of bats, led by a local partner, Tim Krynak from Cleveland Metro Parks. And we funded him to do a park-wide survey looking specifically for Indiana bats. We caught one, but along the way, the most common species caught. Now, this is not to say that it is the most common species in the park, but when setting up nets in areas where you have a probability of catching Indiana bats, like forests, the most common species they found was northern long-eared bat. Now, northern long-eared bat has been threatened for a couple of years, but was recently elevated to being an endangered species under the Endangered Species Act. So this was the most one of the most common species in our forest. Now, big brown bat, that's a species that will like nest in your attic, sort of, or nest roost in your attic. They're still the most common species here. But the northern long-eared bat has declined significantly. However, we still have them on the landscape. We know that they're here. So we're excited to have the opportunity and responsibility of preserving those populations that are still here. In addition to the northern long-eared bat, we have tri-colored bats, red bats, hoary bats, silver-haired bats, little brown, I think I said little brown already, maybe I did. But yeah, the bat diversity is pretty cool.
And where,
we have
where a small... Where those bats roost, do you have cave facilities, or are there... do they have other kinds of habitat to roost?
Yeah, so for the wintertime, we do have a cave. It's called Icebox Cave at the Virginia Kendall Ledges. It's a small sandstone outcrop that did support a fairly nice-sized bat population. So that's for the wintertime. They will use some of that in the breeding period, but most of those species I mentioned will move into more natural habitats, like, you know, trees for roosting in the maternity season.
What about, you got the river and its tributaries. What about beaver? Are they, and otter, are they found in the park?
Yeah, there definitely are. Beaver and otter are here. Beaver naturally came back, you know, starting in the 90s. I would say late 80s, we started to see more and more beaver. So in Ohio, like most places, they were trapped out and almost extirpated and viewed as a nuisance. And we've kind of shifted our understanding of beaver. Luckily, they were able to naturally repopulate. And with all the tributaries that we do have, you know, they are here. They're not all building dams and creating impoundments. Some of them are living in the river, and, you know, having bank dens and things like that. But I would say plenty of beaver habitat, lots of beaver activity. The beavers have been a great help of ours engineering wetlands and improving the park's habitats. One of the most interesting places to visit when you come here is the Beaver Marsh, which was historically a landfill, and we were preparing to clean it up and put the parking lot there, and the beavers came in and they turned it into a wetland, and now it's one of our biggest attractions for wildlife watching and seeing birds and other wetland creatures. As far as otter are concerned, they were another one that were, you know, extirpated from the state. Statewide, there was some effort to reestablish them in a couple of watersheds. But the Cuyahoga was not one of them. The otters that are here came back on their own. Whether they came upriver from the Lake Erie, they do, you know, they're river otters, but they do hang out in Lake Erie along the coast. Or if they came from somewhere else, we're not exactly sure. But the otters are another species you can see at the Beaver Marsh. But they're expanding right now. We're seeing them show up more and more throughout the river. So it's exciting. One of those indications that we're in the right direction.
Do you find coyotes chasing the otters?
You know, I haven't seen a coyote chasing an otter. I just mostly see the coyotes in the fields hunting field mice and things like that.
Yeah. So are the park animals able to gain connectivity with other places outside of the park, other natural areas?
Yeah. So I guess I would say the species that are here, again, have to be adapted in some form or fashion to life in a heavily inhabited area. So, you know, I think some of that limits our animals. There are definitely limitations in connectivity. There are efforts, you know, to connect different areas. The good thing is, and you know, out east here, a lot of the riparian areas are protected, and those riparian areas are amazing corridors for animal movement.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that we do see bear showing up, and they're likely coming from Pennsylvania, and we do see bobcat from time to time, probably coming from southern Ohio, shows that there is a way, right, to get here. It might not be ideal and ultimately limiting sort of the flow of the movement of animals between our natural area and others. But yeah, there is some movement, but it's definitely limited to some extent.
So are there species that are of great concern to you that are in decline?
So we mentioned the bats, and that's definitely our highest priority. Those are the only federally endangered species that we have. But, you know, just any animal that's here is, you know, we feel obligated, right, to protect and preserve and avoid impacts to them. One group, like you mentioned, amphibians before, we're seeing in the spring when salamanders and frogs are migrating to their vernal pools, they often have to cross roadways. And so as a result, they're getting smashed by cars. And we've spent some time the last few years trying to understand the extent of the impacts and what the consequences are of continued, you know, if they continue to experience this high level of road mortality. So we've been doing some studies. We have a great principal investigator, James Gibbs from SUNY, helping us out, and a postdoc researcher, Scott Thomas. And we've been working on quantifying, you know, what is the mortality rate and what are the consequences of that. And what we found is that our mortality rates are higher than what a desired threshold is. If we continue to see the mortality at these rates, it's a high likelihood that the population will decline. So we've been focusing on trying to address that issue. We know from our science that it could have some detrimental impacts to the amphibians in the park. So we've been working on solutions. Currently, we're part of a pilot study in collaboration with USGS and the Federal Highways, part of a wildlife crossings program. So if you're paying attention to the bill and IRA and all this stuff, there's a lot of federal funding going into wildlife crossings.
Right.
And so we're hoping that we'll be one of the sites that we can implement some solutions and deal with some of those connectivity issues and give animals a better chance.
Well, there are two interstate highways that run right through the park, and I gather that that's where you're seeing the mortalities. Is that right?
So, yeah, the highways are, we definitely are impacted by the highways, but for the road mortality and the amphibians, it's more on our auxiliary roads, I guess they'll call them. So we have a couple of roads that run parallel to the Cuyahoga River in the valley, north and south, basically. So amphibians that are, you know, like the spotted salamander, which spends its time in the forest, it crawls out of the woods and comes down into these vernal pools, and it has to cross this road along the way. And because this is like a north-south route between two major population centers, it gets a lot of traffic. And so when they're crossing that road, that's where we see a lot of that mortality. The highways are a different beast. They have, you know, these are major highways. Interstate 271, 480, like these are really fragmenting the habitat. I don't know, like we see deer that get hit as roadkill. Smaller animals I'm not seeing on there, but those highways I would say create a fragmentation of the habitat or cutting things apart. So we talked about coyotes earlier, and you asked about movement and everything. So we've learned a little bit about coyotes and the impacts of some of these roadways. Back about 10 years ago, maybe 12 years ago, we had a collaborative study with local metro parks, and Greg Smith, his lab out of the University of Akron is actually the lab I was in. We had some grad students, Beth Wallace and Greg Frankowiak, who we radio tracked and collared, GPS collared some coyotes. And strangely, some of them stayed within these little natural areas that occur in the roundabouts when you're getting on and off of highways.
Yeah.
They just lived their entire life in that little roundabout, never moving outside of it. So it's a really, really interesting thing to see that data and ask, like, okay, does that mean that it's good habitat and they're hanging out there because then they can get everything that they want from that or need, or are they trapped, you know? So we've done a number of studies that have given us information to try to understand some of the questions you've asked about fragmentation and about movement. At the same time, we see animals like these coyotes that stay in one spot. Others have gone hundreds of miles and we don't know where they are, and they've run off to Pennsylvania. So, you know, each animal is a little bit different. Some are braver than others and willing to cross roads. We've seen deer, you know, in local studies that, you know, they'll literally, same idea, they'll just kind of hang out in a small acre or two, while other animals that are tagged end up 50 miles away. Those things we're trying to figure out is, like, how much of that movement do we need, and how can we facilitate more movement and connectivity throughout our landscape.
To prevent those wildlife collisions, are you considering overcrossings, undercrossings, or parallel fencing?
Yeah. So we talked about white-tailed deer a little bit. Historically, we had a lot more road mortality with deer, but one of our big programs here is the deer management program, where we remove deer from the population on an annual basis. There were times in the past in areas where we had 80 to 100 deer per square mile in certain areas, just loaded up. An unhealthy situation, really.
Yeah, all right.
And so we've reduced that to, you know, closer to 20 deer per square mile, and we're seeing, you know, healthier deer herds, healthier forests. But they would be the one species that creates a challenge for larger animals crossing highways. But they seem to have figured it out a little bit. You know, they sit on the roadside and wait. It's just when they're in rut is when you start seeing a lot more dead animals, because they're not thinking right, and taking more risks and moving a little bit more. Until we have those larger animals, if we do start getting bobcats regularly, and gray fox or bear or whatever, like that. Then we would have to have some serious conversations about how we facilitate and allow that. The one thing that's somewhat, like, if you look at a map, an aerial map of the Cuyahoga River, looking down from the sky, you will see these major highways, 271 and the interstate, intersecting or cutting the park in half. But those are actually, there's a large overpass. So when they go over the Cuyahoga River, they are not impacting movement. We have had deer jump off into the bridges and land on our towpath below. But for the most part, the smart animal is able to navigate its way where it can go under this large overpass for the interstate.
Yeah.
I've kind of mentioned before, it's like we need to do a better job of managing this landscape for larger wildlife, you know, larger animals and movement. But a lot of animals have figured out a way to get around here.
Have you been noticing any effects of climate change on any of the wildlife in the park?
Yeah, I think what we've talked about so far is kind of painted a little bit of the picture where this place is recovering, restoring landscape. So we are, you know, improving habitat, removing invasive plant species, planting trees, you know, trying to fix the river, improving all this stuff. So while we have seen this sort of trajectory of things getting better, there are those alternative forces going on, like climate change, which when you think about what we experience here, so like globally, we know climate change is causing an increase in invasive species and other pests. So we know that climate change is going to likely cause us to experience more forest pests. We're right now, just this year actually, we first detected the hemlock woolly adelgid, which has been spreading its way across the East Coast. To what extent climate change plays into that, not exactly sure, but research has shown with climate change we're seeing increased spread of invasive species and forest pests. So I think climate change kind of sort of exacerbates all the other issues that we're having. So hemlocks are challenged by their cooler weather species. So as temperatures increase, they're further stressed. If you add a pest like hemlock woolly adelgid, we're really not giving the hemlocks much of a chance. Climate change and increase in storm intensity and rainflow definitely eroding away at our streams and the river and having negative impacts on that habitat and the riparian corridor. But, you know, is it enough to cause a loss in certain fish species? Probably not something we're going to experience right now as our river continues to just get healthier and improve. But we do have a lot of concerns, you know, like if we're not a fire driven system, you know, primarily beech maple forest. If you go further south, you get into more of the oak hickory forest where fire is more common. But being up here near the lake, it definitely tempers some of that, and topographically combines with our soil to be a more moist forest type like that beech maple. But we do have concern that climate change will result in drying of our forests, more forest fires, more disturbance, and things like that. But we haven't experienced that yet, but we won't be surprised if it happens, I guess.
Yeah. So, Brian, the park is unusual in having working farmland within the park. How does that affect wildlife?
Yes, it's a great question. There are positives and negatives to it, I would say. The situation, I guess it's evolved. So just to give some more background information, the farmers lease our land. I mentioned earlier on in the call about the rural landscape. So the park wants to preserve. Part of preserve this park is to preserve this rural landscape with agricultural activities going on. And in order to do that, the mechanism, instead of just keeping houses that look like they're farms and mowing fields, we've invited the public to lease those lands and have active farms. So we achieve our goal of preserving a rural landscape in that manner. But at the same time, when we manage for open areas, we're just ultimately sort of putting ourselves in conflict with our natural resource goals. So forest songbirds, they do better if the forests are larger. We would probably be better off for those birds if we would plant trees in all of our agricultural fields. It would probably reduce the access and the abundance of brown-headed cowbirds to their nests. But at the same time, you know, deer love coming out of the woods at night, even in those fields. Coyotes love hunting in the grasslands that are created. So there's definitely, like, you know, you can pick a species and determine whether or not there's some benefit to it. But if you think about what was historically here, if our goals are to restore what was here, we're talking about forested landscapes with forest breeding songbirds and forest animals, that farming definitely contributes to the fragmentation. To what extent it's causing that damage? I can't say. I definitely am not confident in being able to answer that directly, but it just adds to the diversity of landscape and resources that are out here. Mm-hmm. Maybe bad for some species, but other species that have learned to exploit that sort of habitat are doing great.
What's the acreage that's in farmland?
Oh, that's a good question. I should know that, but I don't.
Okay. All righty. Well, thank you very much. We have exhausted our time, but really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about the park. It's very interesting because I don't often do parks like Cuyahoga Valley. It's unusual that it's so close to the urban areas that it is. So this has been great.
I would say there's not very many parks like Cuyahoga Valley. It's an honor to work here. It's a very unique challenge. We have a great, it's a great place to get people out, get them to experience the natural world. We have a lot of, provide a resource to a large populace. And there's something for everyone, really. I mean,
right.
You're looking for a 10-mile hike or a nice flat stroll along the river. Or a train ride even, you can find it here. So for those of you listening who might be traveling across the country, look us up, stop in the Cuyahoga Valley National Park, and we're right off the highway.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Ryan. It's been good to talk to you. Our guest today has been Ranger Ryan Trimbath of Cuyahoga Valley National Park in Ohio, just south of Cleveland in Lake Erie. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org and see additional features of our website. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.